how we're organizing this is really logically it seemed to make the most sense just follow the structure of the complaint. The complaint sets out different categories of allegations, and so we followed that structure in our presentation. To rather than do all of that with one witness than all of with another witness, you know, we've agreed to have both of our witnesses up at the same time. I'll do my best to identify them on the record before I ask them questions, and let's launch into it. First, I just want to make a comment on the substantial evidence rule. This is the rule that that the regional boards are required to follow in taking evidence in enforcement proceedings. The rule is fairly simple. There must be substantial evidence to support a finding of responsibility. This means credible and reasonable evidence, which indicates the named party has responsibility. It's the sort of evidence that responsible persons are accustomed to rely on the conduct of serious affairs. And I just wanted to point out that this standard, although a flexible one, still requires that the board review the evidence with a critical eye. And we think this is important because much of the evidence we believe in this matter really tests this standard. We want to make it clear that we don't believe the board is under any obligation to accept it. Starting at the first category, construction dewatering. We'll begin with the location of the dewatering basin. The application, which we've quoted on top, is the only document that actually describes a location for the dewatering basin. It states that it is proposed to utilize portions of the gravel bar for construction dewatering during the dry season. Temporary sedimentation basins located a minimum of 100 feet away from the live stream channel. Now, Mr. Payne, the application says that the contractors can utilize portions of the gravel bar for dewatering. Did MCM, in fact, do that?
Yes, this is Evan Payne with MCM, and that is correct.
Okay. Now, the application also states the dewatering basin needed to be 100 feet away from the live stream channel. We've established where the basin was in relation to the river, and we've also added, just for reference, some distances here. Can you describe those?
Yeah, the red dot is the location of the pool B. It's been discussed at great length. And approximately 140 feet downstream is how far it is if you follow the flow of the river here. The 70 feet is the farthest away that we could get without running into this rock bluff right here. And this was already a sort of a depressed area right in here.
Okay. And just to confirm, this basin was located as far away as possible within the work area from the river itself.
That's correct. This area right in here, it looks like it's farther away, but the gravel's actually only about a foot or two deep, and then you run into this solid rock.
Okay. Mr. Bieber, can you briefly describe your qualifications as a hydrologist?
Yes, David Bieber with Geocon Consultants. I'm a senior engineering geologist with the firm. I have 31 years of experience in the construction, environmental, and geologic industries. I'm a California professional geologist, professional geophysicist, certified engineering geologist, and certified hydrogeologist. I've also been performing stormwater services as part of my professional practice since the 1990s.
Okay. In your experience, is there any particular significance to a 100-foot distance from a hydrologic perspective?
No, the 100 or 70 feet, either one, is an arbitrary number.
And was the basin in this case located a sufficient distance from the river to function as an effective BMP?
For the purposes of this project, in my opinion, yes.
Do you believe there's any meaningful difference between 70 feet and 100 feet laterally from the river?
No, and in point of fact, for the purposes of this project, because the flow of water both in the river channel and likely whatever flow of water through the gravel bar will be perpendicular to the flow through the river channel, your effective distance is probably in excess of 100 feet in terms of the distance the water would have to flow to get from the dewatering basin into the river channel.
Thank you. Now, we think relevant on this point is the deposition testimony of the regional board staff. We did depose Mr. Dean Pratt, and we asked him whether there would have been any problem permitting 70 feet if it had been disclosed in the application that was the furthest away that we could put this basin from the river. And his answer was that wouldn't have been a problem. Now, the next set of allegations in this category deals with discharges to quote-unquote surface waters. Condition 12 of the certification states that If construction dewatering is necessary, the applicant will use a method of water disposal other than disposal to surface waters, such as land disposal. The immediate problem with this language, if you interpret surface waters not, I mean, to include the gravel bar, is that the application specifically contemplated using portions of the gravel bar for dewatering. Mr. Payne, let me ask you, what was your understanding of the term surface waters?
My understanding of the term surface water is the wetted channel, the flowing stream or standing ponded water. That was my understanding.
And can you think of any of the bridge projects that MCM has worked on that use the gravel bar for construction dewatering?
Yeah, as this job started up, I was also involved with the Van Dusen River Bridge in Fortuna, and that job specifically had a dewatering basin on the river bar designed as part of the plan.
Okay. And those projects, to your knowledge, proceeded under permits issued by the regional board?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, to push this point a little further, we asked Mr. Grady during deposition whether the term surface waters was defined anywhere in the certification, and his answer was not to his knowledge. We also asked whether there is anything that would have provided notice to Caltrans or any contractor working on the project of the regional board's definition of surface waters as including the gravel bar, and he could not point to any. Now, lastly, for this category, I want to just point out there are a series of log entries, and we've seen this a little bit so far today, where the prosecution has relied on snippets that came out of the construction logs. And the fundamental problem with this approach, I think, is this, that rather than perform a proper investigation, what's been done here is simply an exhaustive review of project logs without any accompanying interviews of the people actually involved. And when a Caltrans engineer or a biological monitor makes a log entry or takes a photograph, of course, they're not doing it to create a record for an ACL hearing, 3 or 4 years in the future. Now, we don't have the authors of these logs, and we don't have the biological monitors here present to testify, and that poses an evidentiary problem. But putting aside the evidentiary issue, the evidence still needs to stand on its own. And I think if I was a sitting board member, the things that I would want to know, when faced with a potential discharge, are the basic facts. How much was discharged? What did it contain? Where was it? What were the circumstances surrounding the discharge? Who witnessed it, and are there any mitigating factors? And for many, many of these violations, we simply don't have that information. And the September 11th quote is an example. We have a handwritten note up on top. Mitch Shands on-site intermittently. Some pumping of water out of the CMP was done. We don't really know much about what happened here, and we deposed staff member Kason Grady on it, and he didn't really have anything else beyond what actually was in the log. We have a very similar situation with an October 7, 2006 allegation. There is a portion of a memo that talked about dewatering of footings on the gravel bar. Again, we don't have any of the circumstances surrounding this. We don't have photographs. We don't have any interviews with anyone involved. All we have is just this bare quote without any context surrounding it. And finally, we have a March 7, 2007 allegation. This was kind of a vague log entry involving some dewatering from a pier pit on the South Bridge under an oak tree. It said that water was making its way to a side channel and discoloring the waters. Again, we don't know what the circumstances were. We don't know where exactly this side channel was, where the oak tree was, or any of the other facts surrounding this. So we would submit that these don't satisfy the substantial evidence standard. So conclusions for this category of violations. First is that isolated Pool B was an effective best management practice, and its location was in substantial compliance with the application. Isolated Pool B also was not within surface waters, and the term surface waters certainly wasn't provided in either the certification or in any other materials given to the contractors. And then the other events in this category, we believe, are uncorroborated hearsay and not supported by substantial evidence. So turning to the leaky equipment allegations, this is category B. We want to begin by introducing the trestle deck in a little more detail than you've heard before. Obviously, there are a number of allegations involving the trestle deck, and so it's important, I think, that this board understand exactly what we're talking about. First, Mr. Payne, would you please describe what the trestle deck was briefly and its function?
The function of the trestle deck was to get equipment and materials over to the peninsula. There was no way to get there other than a trestle. The trestle is basically built out of a 12 by 12 timber deck and supported on steel pipes, 30-inch steel pipes on a solid foundation. And it has to be designed to withstand loads. The cranes themselves are going to weigh several hundred thousand pounds. The cranes are going to be picking bents and equipment that also weigh 40, 50, 60 to 80,000 pounds. So the foundations that we have to construct for this thing are very substantial, and it's very important that we get down to a solid rock foundation.
And is a trestle deck is a common part of bridge construction, is that right?
Yes.
And how many trestle decks would you estimate that MCM has built over the years?
MCM's built thousands of bridges. I'm going to say probably a third of those involve trestles, plus or minus.
And this just shows, just images from the trestle deck construction process, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, what's shown in these photographs, briefly?
Up here is the bents, and they're 30-inch steel pipes with 18-inch pipe cross bracing. There's the 12 by 12 decking to support the weight of the equipment. One thing to note about these bents is that they're all prefabricated. Most of the welding for these bents are done off-site, and then they're assembled away from the river, and then once they're erected and put into place so that there's a minimal amount as possible of welding to take place within the channel.
Now, just to orient ourselves, Mr. Payne, the left-hand structure is the trestle deck, and what's on the right?
This right here is the lower decking for the bridge that's going to be constructed. These are the falsework bents. There's the foundations for the future bents.
Now, Mr. Payne, these images, what do they show?
These images show us hoisting equipment in drip pans down to the river bar. We utilized the crane to get the equipment down to the river bar. By doing it in this method, we were able to eliminate a lot of the low water access that were originally anticipated by this permit.
So to get equipment, which looks like a backhoe and a compressor, in and out, you would use the crane and then lower them up and down. How often would that take place?
This would happen as often as it took to get the equipment maintained and fueled.
And where would the equipment be fueled?
It would be fueled up at the far end of the trestle, or it would be taken over to our fueling facility, which was several hundred yards away from the river.
Okay. Are there risks to this process?
Yeah, every time you're doing a pick like this, with this size of equipment, and these two pieces of equipment you see here are relatively small, a backhoe and a generator. But in order to get those foundations that we needed to support the immense weight, we had to send down an excavator and man lifts. And those pieces of equipment weigh 60, 80,000 pounds. And it's no small thing to get and grab hold of those pieces of equipment to fly them in and out of this area, frequently.
Now, Mr. Payne, did the application for this project or for the 401 certification allow an alternative way of getting equipment down to the river bar?
Yeah, the informational handout and the permits anticipated the low water crossing, which would have been right in this vicinity. And then it allowed for access up to the future bridge, Pier 2, is right in this area right here. And in order to accomplish that, the permits allowed for us to utilize the existing gravel bar and the existing gravel. We could have taken all this material that you see here, plus it goes on down over here, and we could have mounted all that material up in order to build a ramp that had to be the bridge, the low water crossing had to be at least 10 feet above the water. So we had to get from 10 feet down to that river bar, and we could utilize all of this material. And in that same time, in order to build this road over to here or to get down over to here, we would have taken out all these trees in this area, and they would have been permanently gone.
So those are, Mr. Cohen actually commented on this alternative that was never pursued, right?
That's correct.
And so we were able to avoid this for this project by, you know, relying more heavily on the trestle deck.
That's right.
Okay. Now, Mr. Payne, the first allegation in this category, the first set of allegations, involves the water tightness of the trestle deck. And the prosecution has rested these allegations on Caltrans BMP NS-19, which says provide watertight curbs or tow boards to contain spills and prevent materials, tools, and debris from leaving the barge platform or dock. Now, Mr. Payne, before beginning work on the project, did MCM ever receive any instruction from anyone that you're aware of that the trestle deck needed to be 100% watertight?
No.
And could you offer an estimate for the number of times that MCM has built the trestle deck?
Probably hundreds of times.
Again, hundreds of times. And on any of those occasions, has an agency or the project requirements ever required water tightness of the trestle deck?
Never had to build a watertight trestle.
Now, if the project were to require that, would that present any concerns to MCM?
Well, the sheer logistics of it is an engineering nightmare. I've talked about the weight of the equipment, just the weight of rainwater alone in this particular area. In Humboldt County, there is a lot of rain events, and it's not uncommon to get a 1 or 2 inch rain event storm. And if you're talking about capturing 1 to 2 inches of rainwater on a trestle deck that's 450, 500 feet long, 80 feet wide, you've got a humongous load just in weight that you're having to deal with, let alone what you do with all that water now that you've trapped it.
Now, NS-13 does require watertight curbs or tow boards. Did the trestle deck have curbs, and are they shown in this image?
Vague and ambiguous as to time. There's no date stamp on this photograph, and the allegations in the complaint about the tow boards extend to 2007.
These are all photographs that are in the record, though.
Absolutely. These are taken from the biological monitor's set of photographs.
So we could find a date to this photograph?
We could. I personally...
Fair enough. I'm sorry to interrupt, Counselor.
Oh, absolutely. I'll just let you know, I've cropped them allowing them to fit better. So I could certainly provide, you know, proof of date afterwards. That's
important. Well, I'd just like to say all the pictures I saw earlier when the trestle was just starting to get being built, it takes quite a while to build a structure this size. Yeah. And here in this picture, you can see actually two tow boards. This right here is a solid 8x8 timber that's bolted down to the bridge deck with lag screws and steel clips. And then there's also another 2x tow board right in here.
Mr. Hungerford, this is Samantha Olson. I just want to follow up that some point after the hearing that you follow up with a list that identifies these photographs and where we can find them in the record.
Absolutely.
It would be greatly appreciated by the advisory team.
Absolutely. So what we're seeing, Mr. Payne, if I understand your testimony right, is that we are seeing a curb here and fencing here. And would the curb have been a watertight curb?
Yes.
And the fencing, what was its purpose?
The fencing is an additional BMP that we use. It's also it's keeping from like hammers or boards or anything from flying over the edge. And it also doubles as a safety.
Now, earlier we saw some images of the trestle deck that didn't have the fencing that are up now. Did that just simply show the trestle deck in the early stages of construction?
That's my belief, yes.
Now, even though the trestle deck wasn't 100% watertight, as Mr. Melendez pointed out, it did provide effective protection to the river beneath. Would you agree?
Yes.
Now, are you aware personally of any instance in which a spill of fluid or other material actually passed through the trestle deck to the river or the gravel bar below?
I'm not aware of anything going off the trestle, no.
Okay. Now, just to comment further on that point, you know, we did ask staff during deposition and whether or not they were aware of any leaks or spills to the trestle deck, and they answered that they were not aware of any either. Now, at some point, Mr. Payne, were concerns raised by Caltrans or others that the trestle deck, you know, should be sealed or made more impervious in some way?
Yeah, at some point, this water tightness thing developed, and yes, they were very concerned about being watertight.
And what did MCM do?
Well, at first I was a little bit shocked because we've never had to do it this before, but we tried a few things. One of them was this expandable foam, which we put into the cracks here, but it doesn't work very good because, as discussed earlier, you've got very heavy equipment on a temporary structure. It does flex and move a little bit so that the expandable foam just won't stay there. But you also notice that these the plywood underneath these little plywood scabs are the holes that were referenced earlier, and what they are is the picking bars in order to set those mats. Those mats are, we take 12 or a full 5 12 by 12s and we bolt them together. There's 1-inch rods in three different places in those mats, and we take them and we squeeze them together. So every 5 12 by 12s that are, so it's 5 feet wide, 20 foot long, that's basically a solid mat. And we use those picking eyes to set those mats. And then after they're set, then we can cover up the holes with the plywood.
Now, so you added caulking, and then at some point, you know, additional concerns were raised, or they persisted. What did MCM do next?
The next thing we went to was the fabric, and that's all that black stuff right there.
And is that a completely impervious material?
No.
Okay. Were there any? Well, first of all, did this resolve the concerns that have been raised?
This resolved the concerns. It's still not watertight, in my opinion. But it seemed to appease everybody, and even though it's a maintenance nightmare, because now you're having to deal with this fabric that doesn't stand up to heavy equipment very good.
Okay. Now, the next group of allegations in this category deal with the use of leak protections. The specific BMP is Caltrans standard BMP NS13. It says use drip pans and absorbent materials for equipment, you know, to ensure there's an adequate supply of spill cleanup materials. Drip pans placed under all vehicles and equipment on docks, barges, or other structures over water bodies when the vehicle or equipment is expected to be idle for an hour. You know, what did MCM do to comply with this requirement?
We ended up rigging up these hanging tarps underneath the cranes that were maintained regularly. But again, as the BMP says, it's usually when it's idle for an hour that you do this. But we ended up implementing the system where it's there all the time.
Okay. Now, just to clarify for the record, you know, we've just gone through the you know, photographs attached to the complaint and other photographs found fairly easily in the biological monitors records. And, you know, there are, you know, this photograph, there's other examples too, you know, really all throughout the record, you know, showing, you know, these types of BMPs in use. And you can see, you know, this is attached to the complaint. This is backhoe on the gravel bar. Obviously, you can see it's not in use, but there is drip protection underneath. Same here with a compressor or generator. Which one?
That's an air compressor.
Air compressor. And again, it's more difficult to see here, but there is, you know, some tarping there and tarping there. Now, another group of allegations raised in this category is that MCM failed to maintain its equipment properly. There are two Caltrans standard BMPs that apply here. One is NS13, which says basically to follow NS10, and then if leaking line can't be repaired, remove equipment from over water. NS10 says essentially to inspect vehicles each day of use, repair problems immediately, or remove equipment from a project site. So, Mr. Payne, what did MCM do to comply with these BMPs?
The first one was that we had a full-time mechanic on this project. We do not have full-time mechanics on hardly any of our projects. On this particular project, we decided to have one here so that because of it's a high-profile area and we want to be able to address any sort of equipment concerns immediately. Some of the other items that we do on a daily basis is our operators and oilers, our trained operators and oilers have to fill out a equipment maintenance log before they fire up the equipment every morning. Every morning that equipment log goes to the mechanic on site who checks it out to make sure if there's anything that needs to be done. That the list also goes to our main office mechanics who review the list to make sure that there's nothing wrong. And we always have The maintenance area for this project was probably about a quarter mile away from the river. It was up by our fueling facility and by our office is where we did most of the mechanic work. And we also had spill kits. Almost every pickup on the job had a spill kit in it. And we also had the storage van, as you've seen it in some of these pictures down here, the shed that's down on the river bar. It also had all kinds of spill kits in it. And we also have a training program, and there are oilers that we have to hire through the unions. In order to be even hired as an oiler, you have to go through a training program to be to know how to oil and to take care of equipment.
Now, were there any instances where you actually removed equipment from the project site?
Yeah, we had one backhoe that was having some problems. The mechanic went down there to fix it. He did get it fixed once. It happened again, and that backhoe ended up being removed from the project.
Now, Mr. Bieber, does your experience include working in and around heavy equipment?
Yes, and in fact, I worked my way through high school and college operating and maintaining drilling and geotechnical equipment.
Okay. And at least in your experience, is it reasonable to expect that heavy equipment will be 100% leak-free?
No, it is not. In fact, because you've got moving equipment in contact with hydraulic fluid and everything else, no, the seals are not perfect. And in fact, I'd also like to point out one thing about the piece of equipment that the geotechnical monitor called the IR leaker, that compressor. One thing that's important to know about a compressor, when you compress air, the water vapor in that air condenses out. Compressors standardly, as a standard piece of equipment, have an oil or have a water separators to take that water out of the air so that it doesn't get into the equipment, a jackhammer or whatever, and destroy that piece of equipment. So they will drip water.
So what then, you know, and you also mentioned you have experience as a stormwater professional. You know, what should a contractor do on a project? What is the standard of care?
The standard of care is to maintain the equipment appropriately, put drip pans underneath it, and that maintenance includes if there's something, you know, like around seals, you inspect them, and if you see accumulations of oil on the, you wipe it off on the surface.
And there's certainly evidence that MCM followed those requirements here.
That is correct.
Now, I just wanted to make a comment on staff's deposition testimony on this point. We did ask Mr. Grady, you know, just in trying to understand, you know, the prosecution's position, you know, what if equipment leaks but the leak is completely captured through best management practices? I mean, in that case, is there a violation of the certification? And he said the answer was no, that there would not be a violation of certification in that case. Now, lastly, for this category, there are a number of photographs here that have been offered by the prosecution to support the allegations. You know, our view on this, as much as they are with some of the other photographs that Caltrans brought up, you know, we just have a photograph to go on and not really much else. So we're left to make assumptions as far as, you know, what's, you know, here we have two buckets full of rocks. You know, the supposition is that this is stained with some sort of fluid or oil. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but we really don't have that information in front of us. We don't know where the rocks were taken from, when they were collected, you know, why they were on this location, where even this location is. And we don't have the biological monitor who took the photograph to interview, so we're just left making assumptions. I don't think that is adequate to satisfy the substantial evidence standard and to justify, you know, a $10,000, $20,000, or $30,000 violation. We have precisely the same situation here. You know, we have simply a photograph of some sort of wetness or staining on the rocks, and nothing more. And finally, this is similar, maybe the same photograph that Caltrans had up. We have a spot on the road. Not sure what it is, where it is, who put it there, how it got there, or whether it was cleaned. I don't believe this qualifies as substantial evidence that would allow civil liability. So finally, concluding for this category, we talked about the trestle deck. The fact that it did provide effective protection to the river. It wasn't required to be waterproof. That was not a requirement of that BMP. But MCM did respond and provide additional protection in the form of caulking and fabric when requested. We have an equipment leak recorded, but we also have, you know, evidence that MCM had a full-time mechanic on site, made daily inspections, had a checklist and a procedure for making sure the equipment didn't leak, and when a backhoe had a problem, we removed it from the project. And finally, we don't think that spots in the ground can support civil liability. So the next category is slag discharge allegations. This is category C in the complaint. And this set of allegations focuses essentially on welding and cutting practices. We've already heard a little bit about that today. Mr. Bieber, please briefly describe your experience with welding and cutting.
Well, I've also, when I was in my late teens, was formally trained as a welder. There's a reason I'm a geologist.
Okay. And so can you give just a little bit of background on the welding and cutting process?
Yeah, basically, welding and cutting are two separate processes. In this case, you're seeing welding going on here. Welding is the joining of two similar materials, usually using heat, and there's frequently some kind of a filler material introduced into the welded area to make up for the gap in it. Cutting is a process where, for instance, a piece of steel is cut apart. You're using essentially an abundance of oxygen and a flame to burn through that material, and you're actually burning through it to cut it.
And so what do you believe is being shown in this photograph?
As I stated earlier, it looks like there's welding going on based on the equipment.
Okay. Mr. Payne, where is this worker perched?
Right in this picture, he is between two of the stringers that are supporting the wood deck for the trestle.
And how much time would he spend in this location?
At that particular spot, he's going to be there a couple of minutes to weld that little tab on there. And that's what that tab right there is, one of the tabs that you can't weld ahead of time because you can't put the location in until after you set the beams. Once the beams are set, then you can weld it in.
Okay. Now, I'm assuming that welding, you know, at heights, you know, on the trestle deck does present some safety issues.
Yeah, this is to build these kind of structures, it's typically leading edge work, and you have to remember that when you're first building it, there's nothing there. So there's nothing to hold on to, and these fellows that are doing this work have to wear this protective gear. They got to wear this hard hat, this helmet that's got a little window in it that's dark glass so that protects their eyes when they're actually doing the welding. And they got to have welding gloves, they got to have harnesses, they got to have lanyards to tie off to these beams. They're moving around welding these little tabs here, there, everywhere. And it's very difficult to be able to do all that and weld. You got welding leads in one hand and you got to be able to hold on with the other.
So, again, how many, in all the bridges that MCM has built, you know, which we know has been a lot, how many times have you guys ever been required to, you know, fully contain welding sparks and slag?
Prior to this project, I've never been asked to catch sparks.
And so in your experience, you know, containment on that level, you know, has not, at least up to this project, been custom practice in the bridge building industry?
Never.
Can you think of any other bridges, you know, before or since the good examples where containment hasn't been required?
I personally have done about 10 projects in Humboldt and Mendocino counties, including the Noyo Harbor Bridge in Fort Bragg, which was over the bay. I worked on the Van Dusen Bridge, which was over the Van Dusen River. I worked on the Bear Canyon Creek Bridge in Garberville, which goes over the same river. And on none of those projects, which are all fairly recent, none of them did we ever have to catch sparks.
Now, on this project, were you aware of any, you know, specific requirements or BMPs at the outset that applied to the required containment of sparks or slag?
None.
Okay. Mr. Bieber, would you see sparks coming here and presumably falling below? What exactly would these sparks be?
These sparks would be the molten material that is generated during the welding or cutting process. That material is primarily steel, which is essentially the two primary components in steel are iron and carbon.
Okay. Would all of these sparks actually make their way to the river or the gravel bar?
No, they would not, because in the heat involved, there's essentially a lot of them are burning up in air.
Okay. Now, the toxicity or the potential toxicity of welding slag is something that's been raised here. Let me just ask you, well, first of all, let me refer you or everyone to this deposition testimony. We actually again asked staff during deposition, you know, whether there was any evidence that you know, welding slag, if introduced into a water body, would have any toxic effects. And the answer was no, other than it might be considered sediment once it's there. Would you agree, first of all, that welding slag, you know, would not be toxic to a water body?
I'm not aware of any of toxic effects to water bodies from welding slag.
Okay. What about the statement that welding slag would have the same basic effect as sediment?
I disagree with that statement, and the reason I do is because most sediment is made up of relatively light, hydrodynamically light particles of clay and silt, whereas welding slag is primarily made up of much heavier particles of steel. It's like the black sand you find in stream channels. There's a reason that black sand accumulates, for instance, in stream channels. It's heavy, it concentrates, it stays on the bottom.
Okay. Now, Mr. Payne, we have heard already that there were some concerns raised about welding sparks and slag, and that there was, you know, a desire expressed to contain these on a greater level. What did MCM do to respond to those?
After the initial resistance, because of what I already stated about the safety issue, we did try to catch as many sparks as possible by hanging 5-gallon buckets like you see in this picture here, or we were rigging up plates that would hang from the beams as best as we can, but it's the physicalities of it all are just, it's very, very tough to do.
Okay, so this provided some protection, but I'm assuming not complete protection or complete containment or capture.
That's correct.
Okay. Cleanup, something that we should talk about. MCM did, I'm assuming, have a cleanup and maintenance program across the site, right?
Yeah, my understanding of the BMP is that when you're done with an operation, you go clean it up. And that basic understanding has been manipulated into cleaning up your operations almost as immediately as they happen. And when you're building a big project like this, it gets to be pretty tough to do because you end up doing more cleanup than work. So our basic way to handle this is that towards the end of the day, our crews are picking things up. On this particular project, we also ended up hired a specific person of labor to do nothing but clean up. That was their sole purpose on this project, was to go around the job and clean up. That has never happened on a project prior to this one, and I don't believe it's happened since.
Okay, so let's talk just about welding slag. You know, with welding slag, you know, this material that you see in the bottom, would this have been something that this laborer would have cleaned up or someone else would have cleaned up?
You can clean it up by picking it up or putting it in a 5-gallon bucket and flying it out of there.
Does it come off fairly easily?
Yeah, you can chip it off or pick it up with your hand after it's cooled off.
Okay. Now, finally, I just want to comment just on some of the photographs that have been offered in support of the violations. You know, we have the same basic approach. We have a number of photographs that, you know, are just entirely without context. This would be one of them. We don't know whether, you know, where exactly this photograph is taken. You know, it does appear to show welding slag. We don't know when it was deposited or what date this would correspond to. I believe the practice followed by the prosecution was to whatever the date was of the photograph, to assume that was the date of, you know, the alleged discharge. But during deposition, we certainly noted that there is a possibility that some of these dates could be duplicative simply because, you know, the material could have been there from the day prior and recorded in a separate document. This would be another example. We have a small section from a log, you know, stating that Gary came to the job site, point out that welding slag remained on the riverbed, needed to be cleaned. James Hamm came later, promised to arrange labor cleaning. I don't believe that establishes a violation. And we certainly don't have any additional information to support this allegation. And finally, we have a photograph of a worker cutting what appears to be a large corrugated metal pipe. And this was a welding slag violation, but, you know, as we confirmed during deposition, there's no actual evidence of welding slag on the gravel bar from this activity. Finally, a couple of photographs, and these are a little difficult to see. This is an October 30, 2006 allegation. It's based on two photographs. The first one on the left shows, and it's difficult to see in this in the image, there's a large kind of metal piece that's that is in the water here. I'm going to advance this forward just one, just so that we can. This is another image of that. And this has been offered as evidence of a violation. Mr. Payne, what is that large metal piece?
That large metal piece right there is part of the shoring that we had to implement in order to get those foundations built. And it got stuck underneath the foundation, and it was later removed when the foundation was removed.
So it's actually part of the construction?
Yes.
And then, of course, we have an image of what may be a piece of metal on the right. And with some of the other photographs, we don't really have any context for that. This is from October 31st. Again, we have two images of exactly... We have two images of exactly the same piece of metal photographed the day before, which, as Mr. Payne just testified, is actually part of the construction. It's, I would liken it to a shim, I suppose. And then on the left, we have an image that may or may not be rust flakes, but again, all we have is the image to go on. So we believe we can reach a number of conclusions in this category. One is the complete containment of welding and cutting material wasn't required either by any specific project requirement or by industry custom and practice. This was certainly a new requirement applied to this project, which MCM hadn't experienced before. But you know, when those concerns were raised, MCM responded. They used buckets and blankets where they could. It didn't capture everything 100%, but it was the best BMP that they could come up with for, you know, that type of leading edge work. We also talked about the fact that welding and cutting material is non-toxic, and there's no evidence of any impacts to fish or beneficial uses. Finally, just a comment on MCM's cleanup program. We'll get into this a little bit later, but I think it is worth noting that, you know, unlike other projects, we hired a full-time employee to clean up debris around the site, including welding and cutting material. So the next category is turbid discharge allegations. This is category D under the complaint. And this is based on, most of these allegations here are based on a particular fact scenario. That involved the construction of the CMPs, also called corrugated metal pipes. Just a little bit of background, you know, as noted by, I believe, in the prosecution's case in chief, one of the issues that came up in deposition was if you have natural in-stream sediments that are disturbed and those create some turbidity, is that something that violates the certification? And the position reached by the prosecution is that they aren't. So we had 15 violations in this category, and they removed 10 of them, and we're now down to 5. And so we're going to focus on those individual 5. So, Evan, can you just explain briefly what a CMP is?
CMP is an acronym for corrugated metal pipe.
And what function does it serve here for this project?
What we were using it for was basically a temporary shoring system, because the terrain here is probably some of the most difficult that I've ever had to deal with is trying to build a foundation in. You're sitting on top of a solid rock layer that in some places is covered up by a little bit of water, and some places it's covered up by water and gravel. But as I stated earlier, it is imperative to get down to that solid rock layer to support the kind of weights that we were looking at.
Now, are there any techniques for creating foundations in a river that you guys weren't allowed to use on this project?
Well, on a typical... when you're doing typical river work and you have to work in the river, what you normally end up doing is driving sheet pile around the perimeter of the foundation you want to build, and then you go inside and you're in this containment and hog it all out. On this project, you're not allowed to drive pile, you're not allowed to vibrate pile, you're not allowed to redirect the river, you're not allowed to block the river, and here we are dealing with a solid rock foundation, a solid rock that's underwater and gravel. So it presented a very tough challenge.
And so, I mean, if I can, it sounds like it's then an iterative process that we can see here, where, you know, you try to fit the CMP to the river bottom and then cut it and then put it down and then recut it.
Yeah, we'd fly it in where we needed to cut it. We'd set it down the river bar. They'd mark the contours of the rock. They'd take it back out. They'd cut those contours. They'd fly it back in, make sure it was good, do whatever modifications, and get it set in over the rock. And then at that point, they could get in there and bag it around the bottoms and seal it off. And then we poured a leveling pad in there because we got those big steel plates for the trestle posts. Get that leveling pad in there, and then the next thing you do is drill through into the rock so that you can anchor everything down.
And let me ask you about pouring the concrete. You know, it's important, I take it, that the foundation, you know, the seal against the bottom of the river, you know, be secure and that there be no leaks, right?
Yes.
And what are we seeing here?
But they're the grout's coming from a truck up on the trestle. They're pouring it into a hopper that they fly down with a crane. They've got the BMP under there to catch any drool that might come off the hopper. They're flying down in the CMP. They pull on a bar, and it pours the grout inside that CMP, which they then level off.
Now, this is a quote from, it's our Appendix 46. It's a September 16, 2006 report to the Regional Board, and describes basically the process the MCM went through to make sure there was an adequate seal on the bottom of the CMP with the river bottom. What exactly did you use, Evan, to try to, you know, create that seal?
The seal was used with the sandbags or gravel bags that and the material we used was the material from the river bar because we didn't want to introduce anything new. So we'd fill them bags and we'd sack around the edge and any irregular contours.
Okay. Now, this is the first one of the. With that background, I mean, let's just turn to the individual allegations. First, we have a September 9th allegation, and this was that drilling debris created turbidity. First of all, what would drilling debris be?
The original permit anticipated drilling huge piles to support these trestles. The drilling that we're doing here is a 1-inch diameter hole to drill through that leveling pad down into the rock, that so we could grout that rod in. And in the process of doing it, sometimes that bit would get stuck. If there was a little pea-sized gravel that got down inside that hole, it would bind up that bit, and that bit would get stuck. And I believe what you're seeing here is he's trying to blow that little gravel out so that he can get the bit back out of the hole.
Okay. Now, look at the photograph, and I believe the allegation here is that the you know, airborne material is creating the debris. But one thing I just noticed looking at the photograph is the fact that the direction, the apparent direction of the airborne debris in the direction of the plume, they're going in two opposite directions. And it occurred to me, could we also be seeing, given that this is a drilling activity, you know, a vibration of the sediments on the bottom of the CMP?
Yeah, I think it very could be. Very well could be.
Now, this is something that came up a little earlier. And this is factually, I think, one of the more complicated situations that we tried to unravel looking through the record. The allegation is basically this, that there were, as noted, a number of crossings across the river by heavy equipment, and that on one of those occasions that equipment wasn't clean as it should have been, and the allegation is that there was, you know, some forms of sediment that came in on the equipment from outside of the river itself and therefore violating the certification. Mr. Payne, let me ask you first, you know, what best management practices did the MCM have in place to make sure the equipment was clean before river crossings?
You got to wash the equipment, but you got to do it at least 50 feet away from the river.
So how would you do that? I mean, physically, what would happen?
They would get the equipment close. They get like a pressure washer over there or a water truck, and they would hose it off and blast it down.
Okay. And on this particular occasion, I guess I could just ask you, do you have any information that MCM didn't apply those best management practices on this September 22nd?
No.
So all we have to go on is really the photographs, and there's a URS report that's in the record, and that's, you know, our Appendix 50. And I think the only thing I can offer to the board here is just, you know, we've looked at the URS report, first of all, putting aside that it's you know, multiple layers of hearsay because it's, you know, a written report of someone recording a written report of someone else. But putting that to the side, the actual contents indicates that the biological monitor who is making the report might not have been actually present prior to this equipment crossing and crossing over the river, and so wasn't actually able to tell whether or not the equipment was pre-cleaned. They made an assumption that it was, and I'm assuming because of the amount of turbidity that this crossing created, but that's not something that's clearly shown by the record. Now, Evan, I want to talk about the September 29th, 2006 allegation, and this is something that came up in the prosecution's case in chief. This is an allegation that during placement of the concrete in the CMP that there wasn't a good seal on the bottom of the river and that concrete escaped. Can you explain briefly what happened here?
We had six foundations in the actual water, and the first two went in beautifully. There was no problems. It was kind of a new concept on how we're getting these things in there, and it worked great. But as I mentioned earlier, as we started moving upstream, the rock started dipping down into the river. And as it got deeper, we're having to deal with a little bit more water. The first two were probably within a foot or two of water. The next two were probably 3 to 5 feet down in water. And in that process, when we were doing those, getting them sandbags in, now the guys are wading around in the water and kicking up the sediment that's down on the river bottom. And
I think we can see here, and this is why we included this photo, that, you know, the river bottom kind of dips down, making it, you know, deeper here, and maybe a little more difficult to create a seal. Is that right?
Yes.
So you MCM obviously had, you know, measures in place to prevent a leak of concrete, and I'm assuming it was as important for you guys to make an effective foundation as anyone.
Well, I got several interests in making a good foundation. One, it's got to support all the weight. The second thing is I'm from Humboldt County. I was born in Garberville. I got family who still swims in this river. I grew up swimming in it all my young life, and it's imperative that we keep the river clean. And so I want a good foundation because that's what I need to support my bridge. I want a good foundation, the clean foundation, because my family still swims in this river.
So this is, I guess I would characterize this just an accidental leak that occurred notwithstanding the fact that you had, you know, best management practices in place to prevent these leaks.
Yes.
And did it happen again?
No.
Okay. Now, again, we have a second September 29th allegation, and this is the one involving the possible algae discharge, the possible cement discharge. And you know, I'll just read from the log. You know, while trying to reattach the tremie, the contractor worked around the CMP standing on sandbags. Plume was evident, but how much is concrete and how much is algae is hard to determine. Given that someone was standing on sandbags, is there, you know, Mr. Payne, another explanation for what might have created a plume in this case?
Well, as I said, I grew up swimming in this river, and everybody knows when you're walking down the river bar, there's always a layer of sediment. It turns the river bars white in many cases, and just walking on it, it just kicks up mud. If you walk across the river in your bare feet, you're going to kick up a plume.
What were the sandbags filled with?
The sandbags were filled with the sand and the gravel from the river bar.
Okay. And so it's certainly possible that just by standing on the sandbags themselves, that would have, you know, forced out some sediment and created a plume.
It's very possible.
But we don't have any photographs showing this particular event. Mr. Grady has included in the prosecution presentation a number of photographs from this day, showing what might or might not be this event, or that might be the event you referred to a moment ago, also on September 29th. But for this particular one, we didn't have any photographs. So that's all we're left with. Now, on January 5th, 2007, there was an allegation of a rupture of an aerial line suspended over the river. Do you have much information on what happened here, Mr. Payne?
Just what it says.
Which is essentially that it was nighttime, there was a suspended line, held gray water, and it cracked and water leaked out.
Yeah, I believe it was during the winter when it froze.
Would it be best to characterize this as an isolated event that didn't happen again?
That is correct.
Okay. So, again, I think we can reach a number of conclusions from this category. Category D, we have 5 different events, and for each one of them, we've put forth what we believe actually happened here. On September 9th, we think that turbidity was created by vibration of in-stream sediments. September 22nd, we know that we had a BMP in place for pre-cleaning of equipment, and I don't think we have an adequate record that would allow us to conclude that we didn't follow that here. September 29th, there's 2 of them involving cement. The first one, we know that a cement leak occurred. The question, I think, is whether or not there's any, failure of MCM to apply appropriate BMPs. And I think that the testimony is clear that there wasn't, and it didn't happen again. September 29th, we have a vague allegation involving turbidity from possibly algae, possibly sediment. And then finally, on January 5th, an isolated accidental rupture of a water line. So next, Appendix E deals with insufficient turbidity measurements. And we've already talked about this category of violation, so we'll try to make it as brief as possible. This relates to how turbidity monitoring took place within the river. Mr. Bieber, let me ask you a couple of questions. As a stormwater professional with experience in turbidity monitoring, you have experience in applying turbidity measurements, right?
I do.
Okay. And you've read the standard and the certification up there.
I have.
And it says the standard is 20% above background, 100 feet downstream from the source. And in that event, then you apply additional or better BMPs.
Correct.
Okay. Now, in a situation like this, involving the construction of a major bridge in a river, you would expect, I think, that there would be many, many, instances of minor turbidity. Someone drops a hammer in the river. Someone, walks across the river. There's innumerable situations where that could come up.
Correct.
Okay. Now, in those situations, would visual measurements be an appropriate method for determining whether or not a receiving water standard has been violated?
It can be.
Now, what we've done here is just to collect a number of statements that are in the record. These are all from the biological monitoring reports, just kind of giving a flavor for what sort of measurements were taken. October 16th, we have an 8-by-3-foot plume that lasted for 15 minutes. On the 18th, we have a 25-by-6-foot plume for about 20 minutes. On the 20th, a 2-by-4-foot plume for about 5 minutes. And then we have an attachment K report to the regional board, which recorded a 20-foot plume that lasted for about 2 minutes. And also notes the discharge was monitored by a biologist who confirmed that background turbidity levels were not increased as measured from a point 100 feet downstream. Now, Mr. Bieber, these show visual measurements taken and recorded for relatively small events. Would you agree?
As well as an event that was also used a nephelometric turbidity meter to record the event.
Okay. Now, for these types of small events, do you believe that visual monitoring is an appropriate method for complying with, a standard such as we have in the certification?
Yes, and especially in this instance where they clearly used an NTU meter to look at some of the events. And the reason I say that is essentially you can use the NTU meter to establish what amounts to an exposure assessment, if you will, which is a standard environmental practice for all types of things. But where if you see an event, you measure that event with your standard, whatever, in this case, an NTU meter, to see whether there is a discharge that exceeds the standard at your point of compliance, 100 feet downstream. you can assess, you can see the size of that plume. For instance, in the last instance, the 20-foot long by plume lasting 2 minutes measured 100 feet downstream, no effect. It is very reasonable, and in fact, I would consider it a common practice to, if you see a smaller discharge than that, a plume 2 feet by 6 feet, that you've already established that a larger plume, a 20-foot plume, has not established an exceedance of your standard, that a smaller plume is not likely to either. You essentially have established that the larger one doesn't deviate so that you can reasonably say a smaller one will not either. And in that case, visual monitoring, I think, is entirely appropriate.
Now, I also just want to make interject quickly that, you know, we did, again, ask staff during deposition and just ask them to confirm that there were visual observations made and that those resulted in estimates regarding the size, length, and duration of plumes. And there really isn't any dispute on that point. The question is really whether or not an NTU meter needed to be used for every single turbidity event, no matter how small. Now, Mr. Bieber, briefly, what is an NTU meter?
An NTU meter, a nephelometric turbidity meter, is a device that uses light or the attenuation of light through a sample of water to determine how much sediment is suspended in it. There are also other means for accomplishing the same thing, a Jackson turbidity meter being one, the Secchi disc that was already mentioned being another one. But essentially, you're shining a beam of light through that sample of water, and you're saying the light is attenuated by a certain amount, and that correlates to a certain impairment to the water, a certain amount of turbidity. You use a standard that you, as typically distilled water, that should have zero turbidity to calibrate it.
And it would have been typical on a project like this to have an NTU meter present, wouldn't it?
It would have been typical, yes.
And these, again, these are images from the biological monitor that we've collected, you know, showing an NTU meter there, being used there. Again, And again, so we have a clear record that an NTU meter was used. Now, Mr. Bieber, having reviewed, you know, kind of the photographs and the record, do you have an understanding for how the NTU meter was used on this particular project?
I believe I do.
What is that?
It's my understanding that when they saw an event that they thought would be an exceedance of their standard or would approach that standard, basically the 20% or greater at the point of compliance, 100 feet downstream, they would use their turbidity meter to determine whether they did or did not have an excessive discharge of sediment.
Okay. Now, you were of allegations here that an NTU meter needed to be used for every turbidity event, however small.
I am aware of that.
Now, in this case, I think what we've seen is that an NTU meter was one of the suite of turbidity measuring and monitoring practices used on this project, that for small events that clearly wouldn't meet 20% at 100-foot standard, you know, visual monitoring was something that was used. And then for larger events, particularly situations where you knew that there would be turbidity created, that an NTU meter was used. Is that more or less a fair characterization?
That is my understanding.
Do you think that type of use of turbidity meter and visual measurements is consistent with the standard of care and with custom and practice?
I do.
Okay. Now, we did ask Mr. Gradinger in deposition, you know, whether there was anything in the certification that stated that field turbidity measurements had to be used by an NTU meter. Now, I know that the argument here is that field turbidity measurements can't be taken by anything other than an NTU meter, but I don't think that offers enough guidance to contractors and others working on the job, particularly when the custom and practice is that other forms of turbidity monitoring can be used, you know, for minor situations. And so I also asked Mr. Grady whether or not there's anything in the certification or elsewhere that would provide guidance that the only way of taking field turbidity measurements is with an NTU meter. And he could not cite for me any guidance. So our conclusions are these, that visual turbidity monitoring was an appropriate method for minor events and consistent with custom and practice. NTU meter, of course, was used for the larger events and was not at all times mandated by the certification. Turning to Appendix F, improper disposal of cement waste allegations. Here we have a number of allegations involving cement waste. Mr. Payne, to begin with the first one, there are two instances where water was pumped from a CMP to isolated pool B after coming into contact with wet cement, and they're recorded up here. And I'll just paraphrase them for you. In both instances, they say that water was pumped in order to prevent contact water from overflowing in the river. Do you see that?
Yes.
Now, let me ask you first, would MCM normally have pumped cement contact water into the dewatering basin on the gravel bar?
No.
The fact that it was done in these instances, at least going on the records, would suggest there's some sort of emergency or unexpected event, right?
Yes.
Do we know how much water was pumped on either occasion?
No.
I'm assuming that it would have been a relatively small amount because the CMPs probably only hold so much.
He already said he didn't know.
Jack? Well, he does know the size of the CMP and how much water it could potentially hold.
The CMPs are 5 foot diameter, 5 or 6 foot diameter, and you're talking about 25 gallons, 50 gallons, something in that neighborhood.
Okay. Mr. Bieber, asking a question from a water quality perspective, you know, would a small amount of water pumped into the dewatering basin from a small amount of contact water, would that present any particular water quality concerns?
In all likelihood in this scenario, no.
And certainly, given the option of either, you know, pumping to the dewatering basin or letting it overflow in the river, this probably seemed like sound judgment.
Certainly the lesser of two evils.
I want to turn to September 8th violation involving September 7th log. Here we just have a little snippet from a daily report saying that water was tested for pH, treated with muriatic acid, and pumped to the settlement basin. I think the only thing we can say about this is we don't know anything beyond what's stated in this report. We don't really know the circumstances surrounding this event. And I don't think that without any corroboration that we can establish a violation. Next, there are two reports of tool cleaning on August 29th and September 29th. The allegations are that tools that were used in the placement of concrete were cleaned out in a footing excavation. Mr. Payne, let me ask you first, did MCM have a best management practice for concrete tool cleaning?
We had a huge washout pit up away from the river, about a couple hundred yards away, that where most of the washout was supposed to occur.
And do we have any, do you have any, I mean, personal knowledge of these events
here? No.
Do we know whether or not this was actually an uncontained cleanout? Is it possible it could have been contained somewhere?
I know we had several cofferdams going at the same time, but... So I don't know.
Okay. So, again, we have a situation where we really don't know that much. It's possible it could have been contained. It's possible it wasn't, but the record really doesn't disclose. Finally, we have the image that we've seen earlier, a September 13th photograph of concrete cement. Mr. Payne, do you think this shows concrete cement? I'm sorry, concrete waste.
I'm not sure. I think it could be when we were dewatering the cofferdams, it was, you know, the volume of water while we're just doing the dewatering is fairly extensive. And as we know, or as I know, living on the river, that water has a sediment in it. And if you put a lot of dewatering in one place, that sediment's going to build up. I think that's what it is.
Okay. And the image on the bottom, that's from the biological monitor's records. That shows the sort of sediments that tend to accumulate in this river.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of it. It's there naturally.
So, you know, another explanation for what this material is that it would have been the outflow into isolated pool B, and it would have been a collection of sediments, natural sediments, that would have come just from the process of dewatering the river.
It could be, yes.
Okay. So I think we conclude that for this category that there was, on two occasions, a small amount of water was pumped to a basin. This appeared to reflect sound judgment. We have concrete waste that might actually be natural sediment. We have BMPs in place for tool cleaning, and we don't know whether or not that the cleanouts in this case were uncontained. And we have one final allegation involving pumping treated water that we don't believe is supported by any substantial evidence, because we really don't know what it's about. Rubbish and trash allegations, this is Appendix G. We have two controlling BMPs. One is Condition 11 of the certification. It says when operations are completed, excess material should be removed from the work area and disposed of properly and not deposited within 150 feet of any stream. And then Caltrans WM5, which says essentially pick up litter and debris weekly and dispose of it. We're both, well, Mr. Payne, please explain how it is that we complied with these requirements.
I touched on it earlier. We do daily cleanup with our crews on this particular project. We also had a laborer that we employed did basically nothing but clean up all over the project.
And here's an image of the trestle deck. And do we see those sorts of best management practices in use?
Yes. You see, first of all, you see that the trestle is uncluttered. It's clean already, just in its state, which not only do we want to keep our trestles clean, but it's also because we want the rubble and rubbish and everything off of there because it affects our production. If there's a bunch of junk and garbage on our trestle, it slows everything down. So, you know, I have other incentives to keep the trestle clean other than just keeping the trestle clean. But in this case, it's very clean. We've got trash bins. We've got the tow boards. You got the waste management porta potty, which is another BMP. I mean, it's, to me, that's a good-looking picture.
And what are we seeing here, Mr. Payne?
I believe the guy on the lower left, I believe he's actually vacuuming rust off of a beam, which is something we've never done before. These guys over here are vacuuming dust and dirt off the top of the trestle, which we've never done before. And then here you can see they picked up all the nails and pieces of wood and got them contained.
And finally, again, Condition 11 says that when operations are completed, excess material or debris should be removed from the work area. What are we seeing here in this photograph?
This picture, I believe, is taken either the day before or a couple days before the time window was over for where we had to be out of the channel. This is after we got the foundations in for the trestle and for the lower deck of the faults work. And you can see that everything's picked up, everything's clean. The only thing down there right now is the stairs that we put in to get access down to the river bar. And fairly, I think it was right after this picture was taken, we actually removed them stairs up to the ordinary high water mark. So before we left the channel for the winter, this is what it looked like.
And finally, for the rubbish and trash allegations, there are, again, a series of photographs that have been put forward in support of the allegations. You know, these carry $10,000 or more penalties for these dates. And again, I'm going to spin through them. We don't have any contextualizing information. We don't know whether or not that these materials, and assuming this is a piece of wood, came from the project, came from somewhere else. We don't know how long they've been there or any of the other circumstances. Again, another piece of wood. I'm actually not sure what exactly this is. I'm not sure we were able to identify it in deposition. Maybe a piece of rust in the middle. This one, yeah, and I the difficulty of this doesn't show up very well. There's a what appears to be rope in the middle, and again, we don't know what the source of that was. And here we have a cup lid. It's in a channel. Again, this was used as evidence to support a violation. So we know in conclusion that the certification and Caltrans standard BMPs required site maintenance and cleanup. And we had those in place, and we followed them. In fact, MCM had a full-time laborer whose sole job was site maintenance. Now, the BMPs required cleanup on at least a weekly basis, and we did it more frequently than that. Finally, we have a few allegations under the category of individual events. First one, this is an August 17th photograph. Again, we have a collection of rocks in buckets. The allegation here is that this demonstrates a hydraulic fluid spill on the gravel bar. I'm not aware of any, and we weren't able to come up with any other evidence other than this photograph. And so I don't believe that that's been established. We don't know where the rocks came from or what type of fluid is on them or why they're there. Equipment refueling, this was an issue. There was an email from Walt Dragolowski to Ron Denhire, the first RE on the project, and it said essentially that equipment is being fueled on the river bar, and the permit doesn't permit that. Evan, Mr. Payne, would you please explain, you know, what MCM's practice was for refueling equipment?
Typically, when we're working in these areas, we'd come up to the. This is a fuel containment center right here. We got this is a containment center that's above and beyond any sort of fuel containment center that we normally build for a project. We've got a concrete barrier that's actually it's got a bulkhead that goes all the way around it. We've got double wall steel tank. Normally, all we have is just the steel tank. As it is, it's double-walled by itself. So the practice was is to, for the pickup trucks, got 100-gallon tanks in them. The trucks, for the mobile equipment, they come over here to fuel. For the non-mobile equipment, the pickups would come over here, get the fuel, and then they'd use the drip pans and other stuff to fuel the equipment.
Now, it was MCM's practice, right, to refuel outside the gravel bar, to actually pick up the equipment, bring it outside the gravel bar, and then refuel it up in the upland areas.
Yes.
And this email at least suggested that it didn't happen on one occasion. Is that right?
Yeah.
Did you were aware of this?
Right? Yes. It happened early on in the project, and it came up at the PDT meeting almost immediately, the project development team meeting that we had on a weekly basis. And after this, it never happened again.
Okay. And so MCM, you guys addressed it internally, and you talked to people involved, and it didn't happen again?
That's correct.
We have an allegation of loose soil based on November 7th. The allegation is based on this email. It says essentially that during construction of a work platform, loose soil was pushed over the edge of the bank and cascaded down below the ordinary high water mark. All we have to go on for this is the quote itself. What we've included just to have a representative photograph is a photograph of a barrier that was put in place essentially along the ordinary high water mark. And, you know, Mr. Payne, can you explain kind of how these barriers were employed throughout the project site?
Yeah, which the big white bags, we call them super sacks, and they're filled with either sand or gravel. They weigh a couple thousand pounds, and they create like a dam, a berm. And then the black fence you see, it's steel pipe with a close-knitted mesh and a chain-link mesh. So that for any of the work that's occurring up above this particular location, anything that rolls down and be stopped by that barrier.
Okay. And so I take it you put them where you thought that rock fall would be an issue.
That's correct.
But we don't actually know where this soil slide was, or whether there was one of these in place, or whether the material was removed, do we?
I don't know.
Sandblasting operations, something we've talked about. There's a May 23rd, 2007 email that's in the record. It says that MCM was using sand to blast rebar from the North Bridge without any BMPs. Let me ask, first of all, are you aware of any BMPs at the outset of this project that address sandblasting?
Yes, there is a sandblasting BMP in Caltrans's manual.
And does it require containment of sandblasted material?
No.
What does it require?
It requires you to do the sandblasting when it's not windy so that the sand doesn't travel very far. It requires you to angle the nozzle so that the flow that it kicks off is minimized as much as possible. I mean, that's pretty much the two biggest things about that BMP.
And so you were following that BMP, correct?
That's the BMP we followed on every bridge project we've done in Humboldt and Mendocino County.
But concerns were raised here.
Yes.
That wasn't enough.
That wasn't enough.
And so what happened? What did you do in response?
After the initial resistance, because it was not something we had to do on any other project that has the same sort of permit language as this does, including the Van Dusen Bridge and the Noyo Harbor Bridge, we sat down with Caltrans and we drew up some BMPs where we used basically methods that you would use when you're sandblasting a steel bridge to remove the paint, where you basically tarp it. which is not something we normally do when we're sandblasting bridges. We laid tarps on the ground, the same tarps that we used that we bought to catch the sparks. Those we also utilized to catch the sand. And we laid tarps on the ground, and we also hung tarps over on the other bridge to kind of direct the sand to stay real close to the column, which all those things were new requirements on this project.
And so if I could summarize, so we had a B in place initially for sandblasting. We followed that, correct?
Yes.
And then concerns were raised, and so additional BMPs were put into place.
That's correct.
And then eventually those concerns were resolved.
Yes.
Okay. So, again, we think we can reach certain conclusions. Photograph of rocks in a bucket, not substantial evidence in our view. There was a refueling issue, and it was addressed, and it didn't happen again. We did have best management practices in place to prevent rock falls and slides, but in this case, you know, what exactly happened in this instance is really too vague to support a violation. Finally, sandblasting, although there was a lot of discussion on this, I think what the record discloses is that there was a BMP in place. It was a BMP that MCM followed, and that when concerns were raised and requests were made for additional protection, that MCM followed through with that, ultimately to everyone's satisfaction. Finally, turning to stormwater permit allegations. The first is that there's 10 days of LAD refueling without best management practices. The allegation here is supported by an email that refueling is occurring in the TCE, the temporary construction easement, near the resident engineer's office without the use of any BMPs. LAD personnel claim they had no training or knowledge of required fueling practices. Mr. Payne, let me just ask you, first of all, what was LAD's scope on this project?
LAD was our subcontractor who did the foundation work and the major earth excavation and moving.
Were they an experienced contractor?
They're a very experienced contractor. In fact, prior to this project, they were working on the Hoover Dam project, the big arch bridge that goes across Hoover Dam. They were the ones that did the rock excavation for those foundations, which that job there was also a very high environmental project.
Now, they had their own refueling area on the peninsula, is that right?
They had one beyond our fueling facility, yes.
Did it look more or less like yours with roof containment, you know, concrete?
It wasn't as elaborate as ours, but they did have one, yes.
Okay. And your knowledge, or to your knowledge, did they have, I mean, you met with their people, did they have qualified people, you know, working for them?
They are a union contractor just like we are, and the personnel that they hire to maintain their equipment has to go through the same sort of programs and training to fuel and oil equipment.
So on the face of it, is the statement on this in this email that LAD had no training or knowledge of BMPs, is that a believable statement?
It is absolutely not believable to me.
And did LAD in this case, at least in one instance, go above and beyond you know, what was required of them in order to avoid refueling over the river?
LAD, probably more than any other contractor on this project, wanted to not get into any sort of disputes whatsoever. And even though, in my opinion, that the permits for this project allowed us to go walk the equipment back and forth the river many more times than what we actually did, what LAD did, instead of walking the equipment back across the river to do the fueling, they went out of their way and they drove 27, 28 something miles around, made arrangements with personal property owners on the other side of the river. So they had to go back down 101 to Highway 1, down around private property, down logging skid roads, which took several hours just to get to the equipment that was out on the peninsula. Because there was a substantial amount of work that the equipment needed to do out on that peninsula before we could get that trestle tied in. So they had to do this refueling process several times.
So LAD, to summarize, is an experienced contractor, and I mean they took extraordinary care in this case to make sure that there was no fuel spill.
Absolutely.
And so the idea that they actually, you know, weren't trained in refueling practices, or that, you know, they were, you know, in violation somehow of the BMPs, it isn't very believable.
No, it is not.
Now there's one August 22nd refueling allegation. and this is one that we've already discussed, and this is, you know, as we've already noted, you know, there was one event where refueling took place in the gravel bar. The difference here is that this is under the stormwater permit, and so we're not talking about the certification. We're talking about Caltrans Best Management Practice Number NS9. That's been put forward as the basis for this violation. And I just want to point out that NS9, by its terms, doesn't actually prohibit refueling on the gravel bar. It requires refueling a certain distance, 50 feet away from drainages and watercourses. But that actually only applies to designated drainage facilities. It also requires minimization of on-site refueling. So it's not so simple that NS9 prohibits refueling on the gravel bar. There's actually requirements there. In some circumstances, it certainly could be allowed. I think that the issue here is that we don't have any information in the record showing that NS9 has been violated. We know that there was some refueling that took place, you know, on the gravel bar, but we don't know that factually that it violated this requirement. Evan, let me ask you one thing. You mentioned the TCE earlier. Where exactly is the TCE?
The TCE is a temporary construction easement. It's usually delineated on the contract plans. And my interpretation of what a TCE is what it says, temporary construction easement. It's an area for the contractor to do the work.
I mean, it's way in the, it's in an upland area. It's way outside of the river.
This TCE area is clear up by the RE's office on the very south end of the job.
Next, for stormwater violations, we have an allegation of 141 days the trestle deck wasn't watertight. There's not much we can say that we haven't said on this violation. You know, it's based on the notion that a watertight trestle deck was required. I think we've been able to show that that's not something that was required by the terms of the certification, and that we you know, applied all the necessary protections to the trestle deck in terms of curbs and railing and fencing that were required under the best management practices for this project. So we don't believe that this is established. So let me turn just with the time that we have left. Can I pause for a moment and get a time? Left. So about 15 minutes left. Okay, that's fine. I just want to address this. This is something we put in our brief, and I think it deserves mention here. And, you know, we think, and I believe that Caltrans agrees with us, that there are legal issues here that affect the entire complaint. One of them deals with Section 13385 factors. Section 13385 subdivision E has specific requirements for setting administrative civil liability. It states that the regional board shall take into consideration certain factors when setting that liability. The precise issue here is whether the prosecution must apply those factors to each individual violation or whether it can apply those factors kind of categorically or to a group of violations. They've done the latter, you know, possibly for convenience. I'm sure it would have been difficult to apply them to every individual violation, but what they've done here is to kind of, you know, group violations together and then to, you know, apply all of those factors kind of in one paragraph in the complaint to a group of, in some cases, 20 or more violations. But we don't think that this meets Section 13385's requirements. The reasons are this. First of all, it's the language of 13385. It refers to the singular, the violation. There's nothing in there that suggests that you can apply these factors to groups of violations. The second is that there is a practical problem. You know, this complaint is an example. We have some categories with 20 or more different violations. Each one of those violations is based on slightly different facts. You know, looking at the different factors that you're supposed to consider, you know, efforts undertaken at cleanup, economic or savings or benefits resulting from the violation, degree of culpability, circumstances, extent, and gravity, you know, all of those factors you can't really effectively apply to a group of allegations that spans such a variety of different factual situations. So we don't think that 13385 allows the prosecution team to structure the complaint and that it structured it. The other, I think, fatal flaw to the way that this complaint's been prepared is the issue of economic benefit. You know, the very last line of 13385 says, at a minimum, liability shall be assessed at a level that recovers the economic benefits, if any, derived from the acts that constitute the violation. In our view, you can't determine what the economic benefit is unless you actually study it, unless you actually perform some form of assessment of what was saved as the result of doing the construction in one way versus another. And as we've already established today, that didn't happen. You know, we have what really amounts to a guesstimate or an impression of what the economic benefit was from doing the construction this way, but we don't have anything more tangible than that to go on. So without that, I don't believe that this regional board has the necessary information in the record that it needs in order to apply the 13385 factors that the water code requires it to apply. The second issue is claims exceeding the $10,000 daily maximum. We have a number of instances in this complaint where we have the same set of, or the same facts have been used to establish some cases two or three different, or to violate two or three different conditions of the certification. And so we're basically stacking penalties, right? It's not 10,000, you know, for a particular event, it's 20,000 or 30,000. And the problem I have is this. We don't think that the water code allows you to do this. Section 13385 says under subdivision C, civil liability may be imposed administratively by a regional board in amount not to exceed $10,000 for each day in which the violation occurs. And what the prosecution's theory is that the violation is different under each one of the conditions of the certification. And I don't believe that that's the correct statement of the law. We think the law is fairly clear that a single act can't be treated as a violation of multiple conditions unless, you know, each of those conditions speaks to a different, they're in the permit for different reasons and serve distinct purposes. In this case, what we have essentially is we have a narrow permit condition, you know, which says no refueling in a particular area, for instance, and then we have a broad kind of catch-all condition in the form of condition 17. And so what we have is, you know, the same factual scenario, you know, violating both of those, when in fact those are just overlapping conditions. And so there's nothing to prevent, if we were to follow this out to, you know, maybe an extreme conclusion, regional boards from just lawyering up their certifications and writing the certification in a way that will allow, you know, two, three, four, five or more violations anytime one particular fact scenario occurs. I don't think that's what the water code allows. I don't think that's what was intended. Finally, just a note on staff time. We don't have any more updated records, as Caltrans pointed out. You know, in February, the staff stated that they had spent 980 hours preparing for the hearing, and they charged out $150 an hour for that. We have problems with these claims. We don't have any backup information. We don't have any documentation. And the declarations that included this information indicated that these hours were merely estimates. Second, the State Water Board has an enforcement policy. It says only actual costs may be recovered. That's our belief of how it's interpreted. It says recovery is possible only for costs that are incurred or costs that are reasonably attributable to the enforcement action. What we have here essentially is a way of calculating staff time that views each one of those hours essentially at an expert rate, $150 per hour. And if the standard is, as we believe, that only actual costs can be recovered, then we think that that needs to be corrected and needs to be brought back to what the actual cost is of the staff time, not an expert rate. And beyond that, you know, frankly, the numbers just seem exorbitant. I mean, as of, you know, February, we had 980 hours. I mean, that's I think, you know, roughly 6 months of time collectively, you know, working 8 hours a day after the complaint's already been prepared. It's just, you know, struck us, and it certainly struck Caltrans too, I think, as being a little bit exorbitant. So, you know, for these reasons, you know, we think it's completely reasonable for MCM to insist on you know, some proof or documentation that these costs were actually incurred, and that $150 per hour is a reasonable estimate of staff's actual cost. And finally, we just wanted to go through, you know, some additional information that we believe is relevant under 1 through 385. First, you know, we have features that avoided permitted impacts. You know, as Mr. Cohen mentioned earlier, there was a lot here that was allowed under the application, allowed under the certification, that was avoided. So I think that kind of stakes out the battleground that we're working off of. I mean, it's not a matter of, you know, how much damage took place. It's a matter of how much damage, you know, was allowed, and then how much through the efforts of the contractors and Caltrans were able to avoid. So all of the impacts, the minor temporary impacts we've talked about today, were already at a level, you know, far below what was anticipated on this project. Evan, Mr. Payne, can you explain, you know, what we're seeing in this image?
What you're seeing is the permit allowed for 50 temporary foundations in the wetted channel to support the false work in the trestles. We were able to do it with actually six foundations actually in the wetted channel. We were able to do this with to put 50 in is the red dot you'd see up there. And for a typical trestle, you've got spans in the neighborhood of about 20 to 25 feet, and you're probably looking at anywhere from 6 to 12 piles per bent. Here you couldn't drive pile, so what we did was we went to a much bigger members, which is requires more trucking and everything else, in order to do spans in the neighborhood of 45 to 50 feet. It requires bigger stringers. It's bigger everything. So we did that to minimize how many foundations that we actually had to put in the river.
We can point to a number of other things that we've done, and I'll just do that briefly. You know, we have, again, a large ramp allowed by the application would have permitted vehicle access from above onto the river bar itself. You know, we were able to avoid all of those permanent impacts by building a heavier trestle deck and relying more heavily on the trestle deck, and, you know, picking up equipment up and down using the crane. That just shows from a different angle. We also were able to, on the South Bridge, there was a trestle was authorized by the certification, but we avoided that, avoided the need for approach ramps and in-river abutments, piles, and foundations. Other features, we had a number of change orders added for SWIP protection. Mr. Cohen has already testified on the fact that a lot of money was spent on those protections, and we've included some of them here. Finally, there was for the bridge construction itself on the north end, there was a lower level deck, wasn't required, but we installed it for additional protection. Again, this is almost like a second trestle deck. A platform is created underneath the actual bridge in order to protect the river beneath. I don't think we need to talk much about this. I mean, it's pretty clear that this was a well-recognized project. It was lauded when it was completed. It produced two very beautiful bridges. It was an emergency project that was critical to the North Coast region's infrastructure and economy. We're going to reserve the rest of our time for closing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Prosecution, your cross.
Mr. Bieber, did you ever visit the site?